Hey, everybody, and welcome to this special edition of the Blind Ambition with Jack Kelly. It's your friend Rick from Blind, and today I have the pleasure of introducing Ash Ahluwalia, who spent nearly 10 years at Google as a product manager and acting general manager for some of the largest business units you've likely heard of, including Google Cloud, YouTube, and Google Ads. Before joining Google, he was a consultant at Bain, where he developed a four-year, $600 million technology roadmap for a regional bank, working directly with the CTO. He's also helped create a strategy for another client to enter the cloud market. He was previously an engineer, he's gone to business school, and he's worked as a senior managed member of Oracle and Yahoo's technical staff. Thanks for coming on the show, Ash.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's a great lead-in, huh?
Yeah, you're making me sound pretty awesome there.
Rick should follow you around wherever you go and say, "Hey, I want to introduce my friend Ash," and then give your bio. Like everybody, like, "Wow, this guy's great. This guy's awesome." So, Ash, I want to know, because I'll be very, I'm new to the tech world. Rick has brought me into this world, and I'm learning as I go. Product manager, I got to confess, I don't know enough about it. So I thought, I'm open and being honest, like, I don't know it. And I imagine there's a lot of people who don't. Now, maybe people on Blind, yes. But then when we post it on Spotify, iTunes, LinkedIn, Twitter, it's a bigger audience too. So keeping in mind, an audience of who may or may not understand it, like, what does a product manager do? What does a project manager Google do? How does it all work?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I get this question a lot, especially from folks that are looking to transition into product management from other functions inside of Google and outside of Google. And part of the challenge with defining this role is that it varies a lot from company to company, even within an org. And so for the last decade or so that I've been a product manager, I've been thinking about what does it actually mean to do this job? The way I kind of articulate it is that the PM's job, the product manager's job, is impact. That is ultimately what they're accountable for, the impact of the product. And that's partially why it's so difficult to nail down what the role is. Because the path to impact changes based on where you are in the life cycle of the product, what org you're in, what your company's goals are. And so sometimes, especially when you're learning to be a PM, you have to have a certain set of personality traits and some skill sets in your toolbox to actually do the job. But the job itself, the role in various orgs that you work in does change. I'll just give you a couple of examples of what I mean by that. The first role that I had at Google, I was working as a product manager for AdWords.google.com, the website where you buy ads on Google. And you would think, okay, big product org, lots of people, lots of processes, you want to do everything right. So you would think, okay, the PM's job is just to go do the processes, find ideas, launch them, and be productive. But that's not actually the job. So one thing I realized is, a good framing for me was to think about, why does this role exist? What would happen if I was not here? What is often referred to for people that do A/B testing is the counterfactual. What would happen if I'm not here? Well, this eng team would go about its merry way. They would get some bugs from customers. They would fix things. So they'd learn about stuff and they would be productive, but they would hit some sort of wall, some sort of ceiling to their impact. And as a PM, your job is, I think the job is to figure out what that rock is and to get that team over that rock. So in the case of this role, AdWords.google.com, it actually had nothing to do with the processes. It had to do with convincing two people who kind of were the decision makers on what launches to align with the product strategy for the portion of the product that we owned. And once we could get them to align with the innovations we wanted to launch and the stuff that we wanted to do, we could understand how they make decisions and align or work with them. That was a huge, huge boost to the kinds of work that we did. And we launched a number of seminal products as a result of that. Now that's very different from other roles at Google. In another role, let's say in cloud, the challenge there was that nobody knew what that team was doing and nobody understood the value of their work. So very different job now. trying to find the stakeholders you need to convince and what you need to convince them of, what milestones of value that you want to prove to actually grow the product, its impact, et cetera. So that's to me helped me understand why it is that it's so hard to nail it down precisely of what exactly a PM does and why the job varies. A lot of my job is to educate and work with the various functions that compose a product team, most notably engineering, especially at Google. And the way I try to explain the role to them is a Venn diagram. So as a PM, I own the why. Why are we doing this? Like, why is it this the thing that we're choosing to do? As an engineer, you own the how. I'm not going to figure out what algorithm is the best algorithm. That's, you know, what infrastructure choice to use, that's on you. And then together we collaborate on the what. So for instance, if I identify, oh, here's an opportunity for us to go after, then I'll say, okay, this is how I think we could solve it. You could come up with an alternative way to solve it based on the architecture that we have and the technical choices we've made. And then together we collaborate on forming what the what is. So that's typically how I describe the kind of marriage of responsibility. And if it works well, you ultimately get to this mind melt, to use like the Star Trek Vulcan term, where you and your, especially your principal engineer, the person that you're kind of leading your eng org, you kind of understand each other. They understand the business side of things and what choices you're making, and you understand what technical constraints they're operating under, and it helps you identify which opportunities are actually really viable and which are pipe dreams and just not really practical for engineering.
Now, I don't know if you did this on purpose or just happenstance, but you have the business background with Bain as a management consulting person. You had it as an engineer yourself. So is that for someone who wants to maybe, who's listening to this and with all the layoffs that are happening, hiring freezes, not sure what to do, looking to see, hey, I could pivot or do something else. Is this something that maybe a person who is an edge software designer, developer, maybe could kind of move into if they want to do something different or they lost their job and want to try something new? How's the barrier to entry? Is it really hard?
Yeah, it depends on, so PMs come from all walks of life. I certainly had a meandering path to the role, but often, you know, there's a few personality traits and tendencies that I think are good litmus tests of whether or not you want to be a PM. One, you care a lot about what customers are doing with your product and its purpose for what they're doing. Even as an engineer, you want to do that. You really strive to understand, like, why is it that someone is using this feature? How are they using it? And what's the best way to design it for them? And then I think I also found that it was energizing for me to have those interactions. For me, you know, a big motivation was the impact of my work. How many users use it? How much do they use it? You know, how frequently do they use it? That sort of thing. And that naturally led me down this path of being more exposed to customers, you know, even in my junior engineering role when I started at Oracle. So I think that, you know, first you got to start with understanding, okay, is this something that you want to do? I think the second piece of it is to actually validate that PM is the right way to do it, because there's lots of other roles that give you that customer exposure. You could be a sales engineer, for instance. You could be a consultant that advises customers on how to use technology products without actually product managing it. And so there's all sorts of other roles that might fit. What I often try to encourage folks to do is, you know, the best way to understand whether PM is right for you is actually do it. There's really no replacement for firsthand experience. Go find a PM in your org and just sign up to do, in Google terms, a 20% project on the side. Just start doing PM work and just see how it feels. You know, what's energizing for you? What do you find interesting about the job? Motivating, demotivating? And you'll start to get a sense of whether or not it's the right fit for you. I think a lot of folks think about the goal and how to get to the goal, but don't invest enough time to figure out if that goal is the right goal for them. And I often, you know, in advising sessions I do for aspiring product managers, try to rewind them back to that question. Why is PM the right role for what you want to do? And what have you done to validate that for yourself? But I think, you know, let's say you are convinced of it, then that path, I think it's, you know, once you validated it, there is a path to get there. I think with layoffs, you know, it is more challenging because there's a supply demand imbalances. There are a lot of PMs out there looking for jobs right now, many of them with experience. So it does certainly raise the bar in terms of the preparation that you have to do. But, you know, depending on what function you're coming from, you know, hopefully you have some experience that you can fall back on, some domain expertise that you can use to make yourself a more compelling candidate. But it's even in a up market or a down job market, it's challenging to make functional transitions. So it requires a lot of preparation, you know, regardless of the situation, regardless of the market dynamics.
Now, I'm curious, are there like a popular career tracks or reasons for why someone becomes a product manager? Do you often see that there's like some pitfalls? Like maybe there's some people that just say, hey, I just want to tell engineers what to do. Like anything kind of like story arc or career arc that you could share there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, there are certainly some common misconceptions about the role, about its status and its allure, you know, that you see the glory, you know, oh, this is like the CEO of the product, and you kind of want to be associated with the glory of that. But, you know, when you get into brass tacks and you ground yourself in actually doing the job, you'll realize that that's really very small, if not existent at all, component of the work. A lot of what you're doing is, influencing people, building like a cohesive product thesis and trying to make sure that everyone's activities are coordinated around that thesis after you've convinced them of it. And then, as we said before, trying to find what those big rocks are and going after them. And that's just a very different kind of job. I'd say probably, I think there's two sides to it. I think there's an allure that you're a CEO, and then you realize, I suspect, that actually CEOs, this is their work. They're not coming in telling people what to do directly, right? They're building orgs that can function and be self-sufficient, and they're, you know, that they're supporting and unblocking. So it might actually be true that it's a lot like a CEO job, but not the romanticized notion that you may have of what a CEO does.
I think that's like really interesting, right? Because, you know, over half of the blind community, they're software engineers. They've all worked with a product manager. And even though there's that close relationship, oftentimes it seems like there's like this like mistrust or misunderstanding between the two kind of functions or roles, mm-hmm. right? We see this, it's almost become a meme where someone will ask on Blind, like, do we even need product managers? Can't we just like code ourselves and just like build the features ourselves? Or, oh, isn't it the CEO's job to have like the CEO's job to have this product vision, especially in the early stage? Like, why can't the CEO, why can't I just work directly with the CEO?
Yeah, it's a fair question. I mean, I think there are definitely different ways to do product management. Certainly, you know, depending on the size of the company, especially small companies, the CEO is the head product manager of that company. That's often true for young startups. But ultimately, it starts to become, there's enough work for someone in the C-suite to do on growing the company that it does not make sense for them to get into the weeds on feature design and product choices. And then it does make sense to kind of hire your first PM and to grow into that. And I think the best way, one of the best pieces of advice I got when I joined Google actually was that kind of around this very thing, they said, look, a lot of people don't know what PMs do. So they're going to look at what you do and decide that's what PMs do. So if you're going to go in there and you're going to whip up some, you know, Microsoft project thing with timelines and deadlines, and that's what you're going to do, just keep asking people, are you close to the deadline? They're going to think, oh, that's what PMs do. And, you know, that doesn't seem like it's touching on all the vision, whys, and other things that you need to figure out as a PM. So I think a lot of the role is to go in there and through your actions and through some of the work that you do, build some of that bridge to engineering. One of the worst things I think I haven't personally experienced, but one of the worst things I've seen other folks in other orgs do is they treat, they have like kind of not a wall, but kind of a baton pass. You know, oh, here's the product, engineering, go build it. And there's like no back and forth. They're not co-building the product. The product team is specifying it and the engineering team builds it. And that's kind of a very transactional way to build a product. You lose a lot of value when you do it. And then I think that also contributes to a lack of understanding about what the PM role is. One of the things I challenge my PMs to do when I'm trying to onboard them or grow them is to say, look, you need to understand everyone that you're working with. You need to understand what they do. Engineering, of course, but marketing, all the other folks. You can't just give them something and have them build. You need to understand it. That is, you need to understand it at the, you know, input and output level. I want you to, for instance, I want you to build a product that helps my users implement best practices. Okay, great. You write that thing. No, you gotta get deeper. What are those best practices? How are they specified? How do we define success in this thing, in this component that you're building? What is the additional information your component's going to need? How are best practices going to be codified? Oh, it's going to be this. It's specified by these three settings. If they choose two of the settings, but not three of them, is that a best practice? Yes or no? How are we going to react to that? You need to think through what this is going to do. And once you understand that, you're going to start to understand the trade-offs, some of the issues with how you specified it, whether it's reasonable or not. And this will ultimately inspire the what conversations that build trust and understanding about the mutual value of both roles. But I often, you know, especially in organizations that are time starved or not, don't have processes that support it, you get this baton pass, like, oh, here's the product, and you kind of walk away, which ultimately I think does a disservice to both sides. I think one of the main questions that, especially if you're starting in a PM role, is I think a great crystallizing question to ask is, why does this product exist? That is a great why question to begin with. And what will ultimately come out of that is a clarification of what's really, really matters about this product. Who's really the customer for this product? What is really the purpose for using it? And from that will hopefully grow a strategy and a vision for where the product should go. And then ultimately, then it starts to become more of a logical conclusion than an independent set of decisions. When you're thinking about what should marketing do, engineering do, et cetera, it just all follows from this central nugget, this kind of deeper thinking that you've done about the core why for the product. So when PMs are writing PRDs and I'm coaching them on that, that is the first thing that I ask them to do. Your first draft needs to be talking about, why does this feature or product need to exist? What's the core reason it exists? And once we see that, then how you design it, how it works, the phases, et cetera, need to all fall off of that. For instance, if you say the core purpose is X, but then you decide I'm going to get to X in phase three quarters from now, then I'm going to say, well, you haven't tested whether X is good or not. So you need to find an MVP for X in phase one and validate that X is truly the purpose and the why for this product. So I think that question is pretty centralizing. And as you said, Jack, you know, I think once you have that kind of deeper insight, then all of the other things start to follow. One of the big challenges, I think, with PM is that there are too many options. When you're told, like, you need to drive the impact of this product, there's too many things that you can do. You could go, as you said, evangelize. You could go focus internally to make the eng team more productive. You can decide, I'm going to take a flyer on some new technology and totally pivot what we're doing. Or I'm going to go do some partnership and work with business development. There's too many options. So ultimately, I think having this why helps you bring a lot of focus and cohesion to what you're doing. And it helps you drive impact. Because ultimately, if you decide you know, the justification for what marketing does is different than the justification for what engineering does. The result will be kind of a helter-skelter outcome, and you won't have the magnifying impact that you would have if everyone was cohesively kind of pointed in the same direction. At least this is what I found in my personal experience.
Well, that makes a lot of sense because, you know, at the tech companies that I've worked at, I feel like the best product managers that I've worked with, they've been able to have this very clear vision and North Star, right? And they've been able to say, hey, you know, this is how we're going to prioritize. Like, I love all these great ideas. I'm going to keep them in our back pocket. And I just need to get you on board to realize, like, hey, we're building onto something. And it's these like levels of step, right? But they all have this alignment of this is why we're doing it. And oftentimes it's, you know, it's a cliche, especially in Silicon Valley, to say, oh, we're customer obsessed. But like, I don't think they really understand, like, when you're obsessed with someone or something, like you wake up and it's like all that you can think about, right? And it like almost consumes you. And I found that the best product managers, you know, I've worked with some great ones at Credit Karma that did an exercise and said, okay, well, what does it feel like to be unbanked? And we're going to take a day and we're going to go to a check cashing place. And it's like, oh crap, I need a driver's license. So you have to go to the DMV. What does it take to get a license? And you don't have the insurance bill or you don't have the bank statement because, you know, you're in this circle. And they developed this like empathy firsthand, right? Just actually going through the steps to realize like what it's like. And I feel like, oh wow, like those PMs, they get it. That is kind of like customer obsessed, right? Because it's like, I have that empathy. I've developed that empathy. I now know the why and what our like goal that we're trying to build.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, especially if you have a, you know, for instance, in my last role at Google, you know, we had an initial tranche of funding and we're all trying to ramp up on like, okay, what are we going to do in this space? You know, it's a big learning journey that we went through and building this understanding of who is the customer and empathizing with their role and their challenges, you know, was a big part of that. The other thing I'll also say is that sometimes people, I'll just say it for myself. When I was a younger PM and a younger engineer, I always thought of visions as like being, you know, a great vision statement is one that you can never reach, of course, but I always thought of them as being like, okay, that's the vision and that's what we're going to do. And we're just going to keep doing it. And you know, you almost had to have a little blind faith that it was the right thing to do. And I think I found that, it's hard to, that faith is ephemeral and you need to find some ways to, you have to find ways to fuel it periodically. And as I've grown as a PM and been working in the tech space, I found that you need to build these little milestones that help you validate. You know, you get that first customer and you get their feedback and you say, look, the reason I use this is X. And you get that validation that they say their why is your why. And then all of the underpinnings that drive your vision being the right vision are starting to get checked off. And you start building towards some milestones about the big questions that your vision has to answer. And I think this kind of rewarding that faith or replenishing it, I think is especially important for projects that are atypical, like innovation projects or projects that are young, where there's a lot of doubt potentially about whether this is going to work or not, where it's going to go. and, you know, for whatever reason, I've been on a lot of projects like that. But I think they even matter for big established organizations. You know, like when I was working in AdWords at Google.com, you know, huge, huge organization of PM, like, you know, 30, 40, 50 PMs, that level of size, even there, you know, it really mattered to take, if you're gonna do something that's just really new and a little bit outside the norm, you needed to build these ways to replenish faith in the vision and what we're doing. And sometimes you're wrong. and it's okay to be wrong. Like, you know, you can say, look, this is our thinking right now. And then as you start to build these things, maybe something doesn't get checked off that you were hoping would. And then you modify. Now you say, look, you know, we're actually going after this customer. And it's really this purpose. Like, we've clarified what the problem truly is. And I think that's also fine too. But it's definitely an evolution from when I started, where I thought, oh, a vision is just a thing you do. And you're always, that's it. Someone just decides it and you have to believe it. That's it. You just keep working on it. I think over time, I realized it's incremental steps, and sometimes the goal might shift a little bit.
I'd imagine that what happens is that you get the feedback sometimes from the customer, and they're not so interested. And then you have to iterate, right? And say, okay, maybe we have to change gears. So does that happen? Because hearing you talk about it, Ash, and I don't know if this is because Google is such a large organization with a war chest of money to do things, or this is everything. It almost feels, and tell me, maybe I'm misunderstanding it, or here you are. It almost seems like you have this project, this product you kind of launching, but it's almost like you're launching it without really figuring out why you're launching it, who's your customer. It's almost did I miss that? Because does that happen? Like, okay, hey, we could do something really cool, and you get it out there, but no one really vetted it to see, all right, who's our customer, who's our core demographic, who's our customer? Or they're like, oh, we'll figure it out later because we just did some really super cool software and everyone's going to love it because, you know, we did it.
Yeah, there's like, so it's a fair question. Certainly would not be a good practice to build it and then just hope that people will use it. Because typically there are some phases that you have to go through to establish the initial usefulness of your product, what sometimes people refer to as product market fit. And typically, like, there are two big components to it. First is like a lot of listening up front. You don't have a product yet at all. You're just listening. What is a problem you have? Why is that an important problem for you to solve? And often people are trying to solve it if it's important enough. So where are the, you know, solutions that you've been using falling short? What do you wish they could do? And from that problem identification, you should hopefully be able to identify an opportunity. And then when you actually build it, especially if you build like a MVP, a minimal viable product, the purpose of that minimal viable product is to validate what you learned. So it's not to say, oh, I've solved it, I'm done. You're almost trying to solve it as a way to validate that the problem that you identified in the beginning was in fact the problem. So you build something that addresses that gap that you found, and then you say, is this actually solving a problem? And they say, yeah, maybe it is. It doesn't go far enough because I was expecting it to do this, and this, or that is close to the problem, but this is like really the problem. So it's a way to clarify what it is you're doing, and then iterate. And then once you get to a place where, you know, people can identify what you're doing is useful, then I think you start to say, okay, I think I have product market fit here, especially, and there are different ways to test that. The way that that I've typically tested that in roles I've been in is like, would you pay for it? That doesn't always work. Of course, if you're selling products that are sold to businesses, that's a very nice litmus. But in a consumer-facing product, maybe the analogy is, would you use it? Would you use it every day? Is it a toothbrush product? That sort of thing. But essentially, like, there's some test ultimately that you can use to validate that this actually is going to work. And then, of course, you're continuing to validate it as you iterate on the product, launch it, show it to more people, to see if what you learned actually extrapolates to the broader set of people you haven't spoken to yet. Are people at the five companies that signed up for your beta actually like the other 500 that you're gonna sell to in that market? I think you're always trying to learn, but progressively kind of going through that process as you get to a final version of your product. And actually, I think one thing I'll just close on is that, especially if you read some books like Lean Startup and other ones, it's actually very useful, or at least I found it very useful to think of the early phase of a product team, the entire goal is learning. And that's actually a pretty tricky thing to get your head around, especially for engineering, because most engineering want to build a system that is designed well, can scale, you know, to 1000x and has no bugs, fully validated and all that stuff. And so one of the phrases that we used in our team was like, are we learning? Are we building for learning or are we building for launching? Because if we're building for learning, let's just slap something together, figure out if it works. And if it does, then we'll come back and design this thing, quote unquote, for real. And that helped us, I think, iterate much more quickly and focus in on what really is the shape of the product that we should make and where is it that customers are really pulling on it and desiring it. So it is definitely a different type of product organization, very different from larger orgs and larger companies, of course. But I think it's the right thing to do early on. It's the most important question to figure out, like, what, you know, is this really the right product to build? And once you do, there's a lot of follow-on stuff that is, let's say, more incremental type of work.
Would you be comfortable kind of like walking us through your career story? Like, how did you decide, like, you're an operator, you're a technologist, you're an engineer, and then you transitioned into like, hey, I'm actually going to take a break and go to business school. And right. Then after that, consulting and becoming a PM.
Yeah, I can talk about that. It's definitely was not an expected career path for me. I'll start with that. I never expected to go to business school, never expected to be a PM. My intent when I graduated, from software engineering was to be a hardcore engineer. The hardest problems, the biggest compute. And at the time I started at Oracle, which, we're now many technology generations removed, but before cloud, before NoSQL databases, Oracle was where a critical, big iron, high skill infrastructure was at. So I joined Oracle and I worked in the kernel. So, as we used to call it, it was the ringmaster of the SQL circus. Any SQL query went through us. And we, coordinated a bunch of activity. It was just a very central place to be. And it was, it satisfied my itch to work on just basically the hardest technology problem I could find to become a good engineer. But by happenstance, I was assigned this role, which was, it was like a 24/7 support role. So I had still my main role, I'm coding and stuff. But I also worked on this 24/7 support role. Basically, what would happen is that a really big marquee Oracle customer would have a gold level support contract, which meant if their database went down, there are engineers from Oracle working on that problem 24/7 until it is fixed. And my job was because we're in the central layer, is to go figure, like, do all these baton handoffs in three different time zones to go work on these problems. There are lots of fun war stories from that. But I think the main learning I had is instead of looking at technology academically, I realized like what really makes a product is it has a purpose and it has people. There are humans using this thing. And as an engineer, it sounds silly now in retrospect to think that. But, I was so into the technology, I'd completely forgotten that. It was really eye-opening experience to see what was happening in the field. I mean, there would be bugs where, like the customer's losing $1 million an hour. So clock is ticking and me and my humble salary, that dwarfs my salary by a large margin. How do you get this person to be, stay with the product? How do you get them to realize this was an honest mistake or this is a mistake we should take full blame for? And how do you make them whole? Sometimes you had to explain to customers how, if I fix this for you, I'm going to break the product for many, many other customers. I recognize your problem, but I can't fix it. So these were just eye-opening things for me. Then I kind of realized that I need to be in a space where I can interact with customers more. This is a very atypical role within the company. Most of the time, you're several layers of management and VPs talk to customers, not junior engineers. So I took this role at Yahoo, basically where you built an internal platform and all your customers were internal, so you could go talk to them. It was like a big base of like maybe 80 to 100 internal customers. And so the interesting, did a lot of interesting stuff there, built the world's third largest search engine at the time, and brand new infrastructure, which I think now is the standard for most search engines and crawlers today. But one of the big learnings I had there is I started thinking of new ideas, things that Yahoo should be doing, and I started pitching them. And then I failed. And actually one of the you know, things that really bothered me, I guess, is I made a pitch for an idea. And Google, who's the principal competitor of Yahoo at the time, it ended up launching that idea months later after I pitched it and failed. So I went through the sequence where I pitched this great idea. It got rejected because the question was like, what's the business around this? What's the business value? I don't know how to answer that question because I'm an engineer. It got dropped and then Google launched it. And that was just eye-opening for me that like products will not, you know, so great. I went from, you know, tech to a product. Like, what's the difference? It's people and purpose. But now for a product to actually get built, it needs to make business sense. And I recognize this is a big blind spot in my thinking. I would say, honestly, it's probably the most whimsical decision I've made. I'm very deliberate, but I just decided in the course of a month to apply to business school, take GMATs, get recommendations, and just like do the whole thing. I somehow got into a business school at Cal. While I was there, you know, I was trying to become very good at business problems. And that's actually what ultimately ended up drawing me to consulting. Because consulting is just a very interesting natural filter for this thing. Most consulting firms, I ended up working at Bain, but you know, many consulting firms are similar. What typically happens is, the customer pays a lot of money to hire a consulting firm, more than it would cost to hire those people and have them work on the problem, usually multiples more. And so typically what that means is that the problems they come to a consulting firm with are important. They're important enough they've probably already tried to solve them and it hasn't worked. They realize if we don't solve this, it needs to be solved now. I cannot postpone it. And so those become very natural filters for hard business problems. And what's even more challenging, of course, is like as a consultant, you typically are not deep in any industry, but you now need to teach something new to a 20, 30 year veteran in a domain and to help them make this decision. So it was an awesome filter, I think, for understanding how to solve business issues. And I worked there on a variety of industries, you know, all over the place, tech, oil and gas. I did a project on women's leggings for a little while. I knew about stretchy jeans, all sorts of interesting industries. Just really, really fascinating. And of course, learning from so many bright people that were at Bain and getting great feedback also. So it's just a great experience for me. And then I did something I think was a little bit atypical. I kept searching for impact. So at Bain, I would do this thing where after a project was done, let's say like 3 to 6 months later, I would call the client and I would talk to them about like, oh, how's it going? We recommended this. What happened? How can I help you? And what I realized is there's a lot more to landing impact than deciding what to do. Often a lot of ideas don't get implemented for some reason. Somebody leaves the org, they can't do it, they run out of funding. They implement the idea and it turns out like once you actually get on the ground and do it, they learn something else and they had to go in a different direction. All sorts of issues came up. And so the phrase I kind of told myself at the time is, you know, if I stay as like an advisor, there's going to be a level of impact that I'll never get to. The only way I'll get to it and really internalize what drives outcomes is if I carry the trophies of victory and bear the scars of defeat. It needs to be my name on the outcome. And that's ultimately what led me to being a product manager, because there's like really the buck stops with you. And so that's good, because if you want to learn what it takes to actually crack this thing, and, you know, build something that is viable, you need to be in that role. So you need to have thought of the decision, but you need to actually follow through with its implementation, see if it works, change gears, whatever you need to do to actually take it to a conclusion. And I think ultimately, at the time, it was, I didn't really understand what, I had learned a lot about product management. I'd worked with a bunch of product managers and I'd done info interviews. And my thesis was that product management is not it's very different than other disciplines. It's a lot of soft skills and it's not an exact science. And so my thesis was, if I'm going to get good at this craft of PMing, I need to be in a place that puts me in a lot of different product management situations, so I know how to adapt to them. And that's ultimately what took me to Google, because it had early stage products, late stage products, products for consumers, product for businesses. And what I really liked about the company is they thought of the PM role as a generalist role, which meant that if you worked as a senior PM in Maps, you can be dropshipped into Google Cloud, and you should be functioning as a senior PM in Google Cloud, which it seems kind of silly to think of it that way, but there are a lot, if you go out and look at PM job descriptions out there, often a lot of them do not allow that kind of switching. They say, look, if you want to be a PM in CRM systems, you need to have worked in CRM for 5 years. Right. And so you have that flexibility and that movement. And so that's kind of what motivated my, joining Google. And then, even though I've been at that company for 10 years, which you would think, oh, okay, that's a long time, probably got a little stale. I've had 4 different roles at that company in all sorts of different domains and different product situations. Late stage products, I've had to kill $1 billion products. I've also had to start with nothing, like teams of 5 engineers or an initial tranche, as in my last role, and try to build up from something and get to scale. And I've also been in between, like a middle product, just kind of, meandering its way. And you need to figure out a way to like get recharge growth and get it going. So, I've been very thankful for having that experience. And now I'm kind of realizing that, as I've kind of grown in working on product and, trying to grow my impact, now what I'm kind of focusing on is, what are the multipliers? So, you've made decisions, you've landed stuff. What are these multipliers? How do you build orgs that build great products? How do you build technology platforms that spawn great products? How do you build these like big multipliers so that you can magnify your impact even further? And what are the skills that you need to do that? I don't know if that answers your question, Rick, but that's kind of the journey I've been on. And so now I'm trying to look for, PM leadership roles where I can kind of engage on that topic. And it seems like just kind of a natural next step. I think running throughout has been this kind of drive to impact, like be very impactful and purposeful with what I'm working on. But what I realized along the way is like what it really takes to land that impact, beyond just building the best tech widget and, using the best technology algorithm. There's so much more.
Ash, I wish we could go on for longer. Your just energy is so infectious. Because it's very clear to me that the one kind of recurring theme, if you'll allow me to kind of paraphrase your entire life story even, is, is this like passion into the, why are we doing something? And like, how can we make things better, right? And how can we like build and like keep iterating and getting to that one place? It almost seems like your job isn't done yet. And I'm quite excited to see what's next for you.
Me too. Thanks for saying that. It's nice to. I will certainly say my. If we're to leave a parting thought on this topic, I think my mentality on career management has changed. I when I started, I always thought that careers go in a straight line. You have a goal. I'm gonna be VP of engineering, and I'm just going to boop, 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 ladder climb, and I'm going to get there. And, you know, I found that it's not that linear. I've come to realize that, look, you have to let, sometimes you have to let the path reveal itself and give yourself a chance to think about what you want to do and whether it's changed. And this is a process, you know, it's not a project, you know, it's not a thing that is done and you decide what you're going to do. It is a process that you go through over time that keeps kind of evolving. So for folks out there that are kind of thinking about what to do, take this as an opportunity. It's kind of a little bit of a, you know, you often don't get the privilege of having these wake up calls, these moments to reflect on what it is that you want. And that's a gift to have that, especially over the course of a long career.
That's it for The Blind Ambition. If you enjoyed the show, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.